Life on Earth may be the result of a common process, or it may require such an unusual set of circumstances that we are the only living beings within our part of the galaxy, or even in the universe. Either answer is profound. A 2021 report from the National Academy of Sciences Engineering Astronomers put the search for life at the top of their to-do list for the next 10 years, and a key part of determining the prevalence of life is to determine what brought about life on Earth. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. My guest is David Baum, the chair of the Department of Botany at the UW-Madison, and welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you, Norman. Nice to be here.
Am I correct in gathering that the interest in the origins of life on Earth has gotten a shot in the arm through the search for extraterrestrial life?
Definitely in recent years, there's been growing interest in the field as, you know, NASA in particular has planned missions to a number of other worlds in our solar system, raising the question of, you know, could there be life of some kind on those planets and moons? And if so, how would we recognize it? And understanding, answering those questions really rests pretty heavily on understanding how life came to be on our planet and whether it required something peculiar about our planet to emerge.
Was there a common ancestor for life on Earth? Have we determined that?
Well, we've determined that all living things that we know about today do at some point share common ancestry. There's abundant evidence when we look at the molecular details of organisms as different as a bacterium and an elephant that tells us that they must have had common ancestry at some point in the past, and that the peculiar features of life that we see, some of their shared molecular mechanisms, trace back to that common ancestor and have been retained since then. But, of course, this doesn't necessarily mean that there was only one origin of life, just that there was only one origin of life that left organisms that we recognize as life today.
What would that common ancestor look like?
Well, the common ancestor of life, as we know it, was already quite a complicated organism. The nickname in the field is LUCA, the last universal common ancestor. And it was presumably a cell. It had a genetic machinery like DNA, had genes, had a complex biochemistry and membranes. So it's quite a complicated system. But we know that it, you know, descended from simpler systems of some kind. At some point in the past, there must have been some living chemical system, some sort of ooze or protoplasm from which, you know, everything began, derived ultimately. And so the way I like to think about it is at some point there was some living ooze that emerged that figured out how to or could grow and divide over time. And it's been doing that ever since for billions of years and is now split up into the protoplasm inside our cells, inside the cells of bacteria, fungi, and everything else.
Have been ooze in water?
Well, that's been the widespread assumption because life as we know it is so heavily dependent on water for all its functions. I think most people would assume that the earliest life on this planet was living in water. But there's argument, you know, was it the oceans or was it a pool up on land? But yes, in water of some kind.
Do we have any notion as to when that would have been?
Well, we can't say when it happened. We can say by when it happened. So we can look back and determine what's the earliest evidence that there was life on Earth. And the problem with that has been that as methods have got better and better, the bound has been pushed back to the point where there's almost no time left. So, you know, physical fossils of what look like bacteria-like cells go back to about 3.5 billion years ago. Those are about the oldest rocks that exist on the planet. By looking at microscopic minerals that were formed earlier than that, geologists have found that even in those minerals, some as old as 4.1 billion years ago, there is evidence of carbon that looks like it had spent some time in life, based on the isotopes that are represented there. So the bottom line is, when we look back, there is actually no evidence of any time that Earth existed, had water, and didn't have life. But when life actually originated remains a mystery.
That would be. The age of the Earth is what, 4 point something billion?
It's 4.6, I believe, something like that. So when the oldest mineral already have evidence of life, that doesn't leave a lot of room. You know, did it take, you know, 3 days for life to emerge, or did it take 400 million years?
And maybe we'll be getting into this in more detail later, but it almost implies that there was some kind of seeding process.
Well, so there is a longstanding sort of idea that's been out there that maybe life actually moves from, you know, planet to planet, moon to moon, through space. It's an idea called panspermia. Personally, and I don't think I'm alone in this, I don't find it particularly useful, because there isn't really a reason to assume that life couldn't emerge quickly and easily on Earth. I think that would be a big assumption to make without any evidence.
And it would have to develop somewhere anyway, so in a sense that begs the question.
It's just pushing the problem back somewhere else, exactly.
Well, because of this geological evidence, what is the thinking in the field now that requires coming up with some theories as to why evidence of life coincides with the timeline for the existence of the Earth?
Well, I think that there are two positions, obviously. One position would be, well, yes, life is very difficult to arise. Maybe it happened quickly, but that was just luck, and we just happened to be the lucky accident that's still alive for 4 billion years later. The other position, which I admit that I subscribe to, is that perhaps life is easy, that this idea that life beginning from scratch is so improbable may be an unwarranted assumption, because, let's be honest, if supposing extremely simple living systems were emerging around us today, we really would have no way to know that that was happening or that it wasn't happening.
Well, that's an interesting question, isn't it? So what you're saying is that actually life could be created around us every day, but we're just not noticing it because of the abundance of life that's already here?
Well, basically, yes. I mean, obviously, a lot of this turns on how you define life, but many definitions of life would allow that it to be fundamentally lifelike doesn't require a lot. And so it's possible that things that have these most basic lifelike qualities could emerge spontaneously, but they never have time to get to a level of complexity to sort of make themselves known to us before some of the well-established life eats them or removes their food.
Can we jump over just for a second then to Mars, for example, which is our best source of information, I think, at this point for alternate developments of life? You mentioned about carbon on this planet that looked as if it had had a life of some kind early in the existence of Earth. Do we see anything comparable when we look at what we have samples from Mars?
Well, so there's definitely, is some carbon on Mars. The question of how that should be interpreted is very controversial, and that's one of the reasons why there are additional missions being planned to Mars to really try and collect more chemical details of what kinds of carbon-based molecules are they, and try to understand how they might have arisen except via a biological process. So it's Mars, because Mars, it's not impossible that there still remain some kind of living organisms on Mars today, but it's perhaps slightly more likely that life did exist on Mars, went extinct with the massive drying of the planet, but still leaves sort of fossils for us to detect.
Why does it have to be carbon-based life form?
Well, I mean, there's a theoretical possibility, of course, that people have talked about of other molecules playing an important role, like silicon.
Right.
But the truth is that carbon is a tremendously versatile element because of its four bonds that it can form. You can build out of chemistry a remarkable complexity of molecules very quickly and easily. And so it's easier enough to imagine, or it's easier to imagine anyway, of a living system emerging through the complex chemistry of carbon than from any other element that's known.
How common is carbon compared to other elements in the universe?
Well, I mean, carbon is not a particularly rare element. The generalization, you know, the lighter elements are more abundant in the universe. So carbon being the sixth lightest is reasonably abundant. But it's, you know, it's dwarfed by the amount of hydrogen in the universe. So,
but hydrogen doesn't have the versatility that carbon does.
That's right, yes. Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's look at some of these theories as to how life might originate, because on the face of it, the real question is, why would something inanimate become animate? And it's kind of an intriguing question, I think, however you look at it. But if life is so variable on this planet, what would we use for a definition of life then? What's the difference? What is really the difference between inanimate and animate, or, you know, I guess, inorganic and organic?
Well, you know, as with many things, there's lots of debate about how one should define life. But I think we can say a couple of things pretty confidently. The first thing that is noticeable about life is that life makes more of itself. It self-propagates, which the chemists would call autocatalytic. So, you know, life, when it exists in the given, the right kind of food, the right kind of environment, will make more of the same. So that is clearly a necessary property of something that we want to call life. But there are autocatalytic systems that are not life. Take a candle flame. A candle flame can grow. If you give it another wick to jump onto, it can divide.
Right.
So it is self-propagating, but we don't consider it to be alive in the same way that we consider ourselves to be alive. So I think what is different about life is the fact that life is an autocatalytic system that has been around for a very, very long time and has been able to accumulate complexity thanks to its ability to evolve adaptively, to accumulate complex modifications that make it better at self-propagating over that time course.
So the flame, for example, would not become increasingly complex. It might become larger or spread to different locations, but it would not actually have the ability to become anything more complex than a candle flame, in your example.
Yeah, as far as we know, there's no adaptive mechanism that would allow a long-lived flame to sort of get better at being a flame over time, in contrast to, you know, living systems, which have this sort of ability over time, as they perpetuate themselves, to get better at perpetuating themselves, and as a result, to accumulate complexifications that something as simple as a candle seems unable to do.
What would prompt an inorganic entity to replicate itself? What would be the mechanism for that?
Well, so it turns out that the basic mechanism of autocatalysis is really quite simple, and in fact, candle flames illustrate that well. You just need a system of reactions, chemical reactions, that have the collective property that they make more of the members of that reaction system over, if they're fed the right kind of food. So in principle, if you can imagine an environment receiving a flux of some kind of chemical that we're going to call it a food, if at any point in time a set of reactions emerged that could feed on that food to make more of themselves, well, of course, they're going to make more of themselves, and the more that they make will feed on the food even more rapidly, and that will perpetuate itself until it runs out of food. So the need to self-propagate, it's not emerging as a need, it's emerging as one of those phenomena that if it arises, it will persist as long as the flux of food and energy continues.
I'm thinking of what may not be a valid analogy here, but I was thinking of something like rust, for example, which I don't know if it has a, you know, coherent shape to it or profile. But if it has the ability or if it has the opportunity to spread, rust will spread.
Yeah. But it's actually not a bad example because, you know, so you ask the question, so, you know, how can it spread? Well, it can spread because there's a set of reactions, simple reactions, actually, that allow it to, you know, to convert iron into iron oxide rust. But to do that, it needs some energy to drive it. And the energy that's driving it is a disequilibrium, a lack of equilibrium between, you know, the electrons that are sitting in the iron and the electrons that are sitting in the oxygen in the air. And so life, as a general rule, feeds on disequilibria, just like rust does. We use the fact that when we eat sugar, that sugar is out of equilibrium with the oxygen in the air. We know that because if you take a flame and light a sugar cube, it will burn very well. But we take advantage of that disequilibrium to drive all of our own living processes and make more human matter over time.
And why would something become more complex? I can see where it would spread now, but why would it actually become more complex?
Yeah, well, it's one of these things that, complexity usually comes at a cost. As a generalization, something that is more complex, which we usually would take to mean is more out of equilibrium with its environment, is more different from the environment than it was before. For something to become more complex, it has to burn extra energy to get there. So you would have thought that it would be disfavored.
Yeah. But the
strange thing is that if you have alternative autocatalytic systems, and one of them is better at self-propagating for some reason, that one will win out even if it acquires more complexity. So this process, we call this loosely selection, is a process that means that more complex forms can sometimes be favored. And if they are favored, they will tend to persist such that over time, in this case over very long periods of time, you can get extremely complicated forms emerging.
And how then does that extend, that complexity, to actually reproducing in some form so that you have an entity here mm-hmm. and then another one that's completely independent of it and not connected to it?
Well, so that actually relates to some of the alternative ways that people have tried to think about how life actually originated. So, you know, what we're trying to explain is how did the first system capable of evolving this, what was it like? So this first evolver, and one scenario is from the very beginning, it was a blob of matter. It was individuated just like a cell is. So there was some chunk of matter, people sometimes call it a protocell, that emerged spontaneously from the very beginning with some sort of boundary. And when it would self-propagate, and in the process, it would make more of itself, and then would just spontaneously split into two. So that scenario, which is sort of sometimes called the proto-cell first scenario, would say that that ability to grow and divide and make separate individuated things came first. But there are other theories that would imagine that actually living systems begin much more spread out without sharp edges, and that the ability to form edges, form individuals, is actually something that might have come a little later. It might have actually been one of these complexifications that evolved adaptively over time.
Well, let's look at those three theories then, these three theories of how life originated and then changed, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, David Baum, and we're looking at theories of the origin of life. And David, you've already mentioned this first one, the protocell theory. Is that still valid? How did that theory come about?
Well, so if you think back to the time before we really understood the details of how cells work, cells look just like a sort of a bag of chemicals that would grow and divide. And so it kind of makes sense that the earliest theories for the origin of life imagines that this could happen spontaneously. And the most famous proponent of this was a Russian chemist called Alexander Oparin, who did chemistry experiments in which he took proteins, mixed them up, and found that they would spontaneously form droplets. And he noticed that these droplets could have a complicated composition, and some of these droplets would do some interesting chemistry. And so he sort of imagined that if there were these proteins around, they would form these droplets, and maybe some of them would, by chance, make more of the same proteins and components that compose the droplet. So they would make more, they would grow, they would be autocatalytic. And so that view sort of held sway for most until the middle of the 20th century. And in some sense, it's kind of ironic that in 1953, it sort of got both, it's very good news and very bad news. So the very good news was these famous experiments done at the University of Chicago by Stanley Miller and Harold Urey, in which they took what were putatively prebiotic atmospheres, and they stuck electric shocks through them. And they found many components being produced, including amino acids, the building blocks of proteins, which Oparin had focused on. So it seemed like supportive of the general idea. But the bad news was that this paper was published just a month after the publication of The Structure of DNA.
Seems to happen a lot in science.
Yeah. And that completely refocused the entire field. Because between, you know, with the discovery of DNA and then figuring out the genetic code and how organisms actually work, it became clear that firstly, that even the most simple-looking organism is extremely complicated. Secondly, that they are complicated in the same way, pointing to a common ancestor. And thirdly, that they all have this genetic system that it seems to be the key to how they function. They need the genetic machinery not just to leave offspring that look like themselves, but also to control their development and their metabolism during their lifetime. And so it made everybody shift attention to the question, really, of how a genetic system evolved. And the result of that was the gene-first theories, which put the gene at the very, very beginning of this.
In that previous system, and I don't know if it plays into either of the other two that we'll be getting to, but what is the role of electricity?
Well, so electricity, I mean, there's this electric spark way of doing complicated chemistry that Miller and Urey used in their initial experiments. But I think electricity more generally plays an important role in modern life. There's a small electrical charge across all of our membranes that is actually essential for the functioning of life. And people who to this day still favor a proto-cell-first model will point to this. They will say that really no life could have functioned without a membrane across which some kind of electrical charge was maintained. And so in that sense, then, electricity is seen as a very central principle for a lot of life and by a lot of origin of life researchers.
I do seem to remember vivid pictures in a textbook from many years ago that had this kind of chemical soup in the early Earth, and then a lightning bolt comes down and changes things into proto-life forms. So I guess that would have been pre-DNA thinking there.
Yes, that's just this idea of, but prebiotic soup, just a mess of stuff, and with DNA coming later, presumably.
Well, so the gene first model, that comes with the discovery of DNA?
Yeah, following the discovery of DNA and how the genetic code works, and that people realize that sort of the information can be carried in these nucleic acid molecules like RNA. And it was imagined that, well, just suppose that these RNA molecules are forming spontaneously on the prebiotic Earth. If at any point one of these RNA molecules happened by chance to be able to make more of itself, to fold up into a structure that could actually copy itself, then you would be often to the races, because you would have everything you need. You'd have an information-carrying molecule, the RNA itself, and you've got a way to make more of it, which is the RNA molecule as well. And so that so-called RNA world theory, I think it's fair to say, has dominated the origin of life discipline from about the 1970s until almost the present. because it just seemed to provide a it focused attention on the gene, which seemed so central, and it provided a way to very quickly get off the ground with one magic molecule that could do everything.
Well, I seem to recall, though, that one of the problems, if you're going to try to, you know, say, reconstitute an ancient life form, is that a lot of that genetic information is easily corrupted over time.
That is indeed one of the major problems with the sort of gene first hypothesis, is that it would have to be not just able to copy itself, but it would have to able to copy itself very accurately. And all of the molecular work that has been done has suggested that it's extremely unlikely that that is possible. In fact, you know, and that's only one of the problems with the theory. I don't know if you want me to list some of the others.
Oh, how about?
Well, I mean, for one, it's nice to say that long RNA molecules could emerge spontaneously, but RNA is a very unstable molecule, and it doesn't really form easily in nature. And the second thing is that, okay, suppose one could emerge that was able to copy an RNA sequence into another RNA sequence. Well, all the RNAs that we know, they don't copy themselves. They copy their complements. So every RNA sequence has a complementary sequence that can be copied into it. But what this means is that in order for RNA to actually function, you need both the complement and the magic RNA to arise simultaneously and match one another, which also seems sort of astronomically improbable.
Are you saying that the complement is unique to the new copy?
Yeah. So, yes, exactly. So it's like, you know, you've got a right-handed glove and a left-handed glove, and the right-handed glove can copy a left-handed glove into a right-handed glove. But what that means is that but the left-handed glove can't do anything. So you kind of need to have both appear at once for them to be able to start replicating.
And what would be the mechanism for that?
Well, that's the problem. No one knows of any. So this is why I think many of us have become disenchanted with the RNA world model.
Let me digress here for a second, probably. This business of the unstable RNA and the fact that it doesn't copy that well, according to the contradictions of this theory, the gene-first theory, is that really the same issue that has to do with aging? In other words, are we just talking about the kind of the duration of the copies? Because if we're talking about humans, let's say, isn't aging just a matter of increasingly bad copying of genetic material?
Well, absolutely, yes. That is definitely part of the reason for aging. But of course, you know, if you think about life in the big picture, life has remained living for 4 billion years. So there's nothing inherent in life that says you have to age, you have to get old. It's just that there's a cost to be paid for an energetic cost for making the repairs. And so, effectively life has been doing that by a lot of death, actually. But within a single organism like a human or any organism that ages, evolutionarily, it's often a better bet to spend less money on repair, but know that you're going to be able to reproduce more, in your lifetime.
So, to use a really basic analogy, I suppose, parent investing energy not in parent but in child?
Yes. That's exactly right. That's basically the principle of the evolutionary theory of aging basically says exactly that.
Well, a lot of people would agree with that without knowing anything about the science of it.
Yeah.
Are there other issues then with this gene-first model?
Well, I guess the last just more sort of trivial issue in a sense is just this idea that a clever RNA molecule can build a cell around it requires at least some explanation how it would do it. Since I have been following the field, I've never really found the RNA world or the gene first models to be complete, at least.
Are we starting with some kind of, thinking back to whatever it would have been, high school biology, or perhaps even something earlier, difference between a plant cell and an animal cell, cell wall versus cell membrane. Are we talking about these early life forms? Are we talking about something with a cell wall or a membrane?
Well, so, again, we don't really know if the very first things even had membranes or were compartments. They could have just been sort of just slimes without edges.
Some of them still are.
Yes. certainly Luca, that's the last universal common ancestor, was a cell, and it had a membrane. And I think, I can't remember whether the current hypothesis that it had a cell wall or not, but there's no reason that it needed to have a cell wall.
All right, so we've knocked off pretty much the protocell first model, and the gene first model has these problems also. What do we have to go on now?
Well, broad sweeps here. The last of a class of theories might be called metabolism first. And these ideas just imagine that what came first was not any one, it wasn't a single individuated structure, and it wasn't an individual molecule with clever abilities, but it was a collection of chemicals that could engage in reactions that made more of themselves. In other words, it was just basically naked autocatalysis. It was a set of reactions that could collectively make more of the reactants.
And can we recreate that process in the lab?
Well, that's something that we're trying to do, that I've become interested in trying to do. So just to give you a bit of a personal history here, so I'm not a chemist. I'm an evolutionary biologist, and I've been teaching evolutionary biology for several decades now. And I would always teach about the origin of life. And I started teaching about the origin of life, I guess, in the maybe late 90s. And I had a friend of mine told me to read this paper that came out in, it was like 1988, by a German patent attorney. So it sounds strange. But he had, his name is Günther Wächtershauser. And he he's a brilliant chemist. And he had this theory that about how life could have begun in the form of autocatalytic chemical reactions that look very much like the metabolism that is going on within each of our cells. But he speculated that instead of emerging inside a cell or under the control of a gene, they just emerge stuck onto a mineral surface. And he in particular focused attention on a mineral called pyrite or fool's gold.
Yeah.
So he speculated that that life could have originated with autocatalytic chemical reactions that look like metabolism, kind of emerging almost like a slime on a surface. And what intrigued me was he speculated that right away there would be some kind of selective process which would say that any autocatalytic system within there that was better at sticking to the surface and growing over the surface would outcompete any that didn't stick as well and would get washed away.
The surface being some providing what, nutrition or position or what?
Well, in his model, both. So it's both providing a way to concentrate molecules onto like a surface where reactions can happen more efficiently. And in his case, it was also providing chemical energy from the pyrite itself. I read this and I started thinking that actually maybe, you know, this kind of stuff could be tested in the lab. It doesn't seem that complicated. Of course, I'm not a chemist, so maybe I didn't know what I was getting myself into. But it seemed like there was a class of experiments that could be done following this idea to see if it held water. And that's how I ended up getting into this field, actually.
Well, let's look at the details of your research into this metabolism first theory as the origin of life when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air, and my guest today is David Baum, an evolutionary biologist, among other things. And we've been talking about theories of the origin of life. And two of them have been somewhat dismissed, I guess, by now. The protocell first model from the early 20th century, and then the gene first model, and now more recently, at least in David's view, the metabolism first theory, which has yet to have been discredited, and I guess far from it. As you research this metabolism first theory, David, what are you finding?
Well, so the inspiration for this, as I said, was to be able to look to see if indeed chemical systems may be associated with mineral surfaces could show behavior that looked like evolution. And of course, I'm an evolutionary biologist, so this is kind of the kind of stuff I think about and know about a little bit. I don't know as much about the underlying chemistry, though. So what I began to do was collaborate with several chemists to start thinking about, just in practice, supposing that autocatalytic chemical systems could emerge on mineral surfaces, how would we know that? How could we detect them? And we came up with this idea, which is a relatively simple idea, which is that if an autocatalytic system emerged, it would propagate itself. And you can't propagate yourself for free. You have to eat something. And so the environment would change. And so we came up with an experiment that I can kind of maybe describe metaphorically. So imagine that you think you have some invisible rabbits and you want to know if you do or you don't. The one thing you could do is you could take a field with lots of hay in it, and you could stick the invisible rabbits in there, and you come back a week or two later, or let's say 3 months later, and you find that, you know, there's less hay. You say, okay, so the hay's gone away, so there could be rabbits here. But right. I can't see the rabbits, but they could be here. Because it could just be that the hay blew away.
Yes.
Or something. So how would you know that it really were rabbits that were there? Well, one thing you could do is you could take, you know, one-tenth of the space of the field, figure, well, I probably got a tenth as many rabbits as there were, if there are any, put them into a new arena or space with the same amount of hay as the last time, and let them grow again. Let them go again. And the prediction is that the rabbits, because rabbits reproduce, there should be more rabbits now that, so you should have started with more rabbits than you began with last time.
Right.
And so there should actually be now less hay at the end of this generation than there was in the last generation. And so by looking at the way in which the amount of hay changes every time you transfer some fraction of the invisible rabbits from one arena to another arena, you can see that you can detect evidence of a system that's there that is self-propagating because the amount of food that's disappearing is increasing. And it should actually increase at an exponential rate. It should get faster, at least for a time. The food should actually start disappearing faster and faster.
As you have more invisible rabbits.
Yes, so you're starting with more invisible rabbits, so you're going to get less hay at the end. And so we do something kind of similar, but in a chemical setting. So what we do is we create little vials that are, you can think of this vial as a microcosm of the ancient earth. So we put in some minerals, and in fact we use ground up iron pyrite, and we put in a prebiotic soup, so the kinds of chemicals that the Miliuri experiments told us might have been sitting in the oceans, a long time ago. And then we have some gas in there that's the atmosphere. And we leave it to incubate for a period of time. And then we measure just some general properties of the mixture. And then we take one-tenth of it and put it into a fresh vial that contains some fresh minerals and some fresh soup and fresh atmosphere. And we do it again. And we do this over many transfers, generation by generation, measuring the properties of the chemical mixture at the end of each generation to see if it changes. And what we found is that we do see systematic changes over time, but they are a little more complicated than we were hoping for. It's not like a tidy, you know, rabbits populating kind of pattern. We actually see boom and bust cycles. So what we would find is that it looks like, if using going back to the rabbits, it looks like the number of rabbits grows and grows and grows and grows, and then suddenly they go extinct. And of course, one interpretation is they finished all the hay, so there's no hay left, and they all died before you could transfer them to the next generation. So we don't know if that's what's happening. There's many other possible explanations. So we're just now moving to try and unpack this with much more chemical detail, using sophisticated chemical methods to analyze exactly what chemicals are disappearing and appearing during these incubations.
Is there any kind of byproduct from these processes?
Well, there would be, yes. Yeah. So it, not only do rabbits eat hay, they generate waste. So that's also something that, in principle, we could detect would be the waste products of these autocatalytic systems. And the hope is that you not only, and this might be overly wishful thinking, but it feels like if you could keep this experiment going for long enough, supposing there were autocatalytic systems present, there might actually be different kinds of autocatalytic systems that would begin competing with each other, and then you would start seeing an evolution-like process emerging spontaneously, in which they actually keep getting better and better at eating hay and leaving waste. So that's sort of the aspiration is that if we keep doing these kinds of experiments, we may be able to find direct evidence that these spontaneously emerging chemical systems can behave somewhat like organisms.
Including a kind of a natural selection.
Exactly, yes, yeah. So that's in some, for me, again, as an evolutionary biologist, that is the really sort of exciting idea in here, is this notion that you maybe don't need genes to evolve by natural selection, that evolution by natural selection may be something that can happen with systems that where information is carried through time, not in molecules, not in individual molecules, but in the composition of chemical mixtures that are propagating themselves autocatalytically.
Do you see evidence that complexity will always win out over the less complex?
There's no reason for that in general. At least nobody has identified a general reason for that. And we do know cases in modern life where simplicity wins out. We know that parasites, for example, live in such a stable environment that they tend to become much more simple than their ancestors. So there's no guarantee that one would see complexity. But it's nice to imagine that if you did this long enough, you could start seeing some sorts of complexifications that would be sort of begin looking truly lifelike.
Now, the original process, whatever it was exactly, obviously took a long time to get us all the way up to, say,
any cell.
A person.
Well, for sure.
pick one that's more complex or less complex as suits you. But we're talking, well, to round it off, 4 billion years for that. So what are your prospects in the lab? How complex are you likely to be able to evolve?
I'm sure not very complex at all. So that's the thing is, you know, I've set my sights low. For me, I consider it a win if we could find evidence of sort of spontaneously emerging, self-propagating systems that have the ability to complexify adaptively. But I don't expect them to do so at any kind of rate that would allow us to see interesting complexities, you know, in my lifetime. There's some good reasons to think that in order to really evolve efficiently, you do need genes. And while I have ideas, we have mathematical models now of how a genetic system might emerge out of an autocatalytic metabolism, I'm sure that would take time. And then you've still got all of the constraints that are implicit in the rate of evolution that just come from the fact that evolution works by many things dying and few living, which just limits how fast things can happen.
Can you give us some kind of a timeline as to some of the milestones in evolution? I'm thinking, for example, at some point, organisms develop an ability to find light.
Yeah. Well, so that's a good one you mentioned, actually, because that's one area where I don't know the answer when the ability to use light energy came into play. It could have been there right at the beginning, or maybe it was a skill, if you will, that was learned later. And I don't know. I also don't know, you know, when a cell evolve, whether it was right at the beginning or whether systems began as slimes on minerals, with the cell evolving initially maybe just as a way to get from one mineral to another mineral.
Well, you mentioned these droplets, for example. That would almost seem like an analogy to a cell.
Yes, and that would be right at the beginning. But then it is trickier to understand how you go from a droplet to a cell, but maybe you can do that. So, you know, there's lots of things we don't really know. We don't have the ordering worked out. I think many people would suspect that within this framework that the origin of the genetic machinery probably came after some kind of cellular system was around, just because it requires a slightly higher level of evolutionary efficiency than could have been around before there were cells.
What is the trigger for cell division?
Well, so again, it's all speculation, but people would generally say that, you know, initially it would be sort of fairly spontaneous, that the physics would say that when you get a cell gets bigger and bigger and bigger, at some point, spontaneously, it will tend to split into two and break up. But, you know, there's also going to be some kind of selection at this point for a cell that is able to do that in a regulated manner and do so in a way to ensure that the important parts of the cell end up in both daughter cells, not just one of them. And so the evolution of a cell cycle with regular and controlled growth and division and growth and division surely happen pretty soon after you have a cell.
And at some point you have cells that are different enough that you mentioned earlier competition.
Mm-hmm.
And one kind of cell prevailing over another. I mean, they're actually, I guess there's a difference between competition and actual conflict.
Well, so, I mean, these phenomena, conflict, competition, actually don't just start when you have cells. So we've actually done mathematical modeling in my research group that shows that autocatalytic cycles can interact in exactly the same way. So two autocatalytic cycles, they can compete. One could predate on the other. They could be mutualist, meaning they each help each other. That comes right at the beginning. And in fact, to be honest, the way that I think of this early metabolism is not so much as just a bunch of chemical reactions, but I think of it as an ecology of autocatalytic systems. That right from the beginning, these autocatalytic systems emerge spontaneously and they compete and they eat one another. And that ecosystem changes over time, much the same way that a biological ecosystem changes over time. Like, you know, you take a bit of bare rock, it will gradually get populated by a more and more complicated ecosystem.
And what are the environmental requirements for these early, I'll call them proto-life processes that you are creating?
Well, so all you really need is some kind of constant ongoing flux of food that is sort of contains some sort of disequilibrium, to come back to what I said to earlier. So, you know, by disequilibrium, I mean that you do need this food to contain energy that can drive chemistry. And so as long as you keep providing some kind of flux of food molecules with energy into a system, in principle, it can keep on going. And that, by the way, is really, I think, why life has persisted for so long, is that life is a system that feeds specifically on a set of chemical disequilibria that the planet is constantly regenerating.
Regenerating?
Well, so, yes, I mean, so light, well, the light is constantly being provided, so that's one source of energy that continually is being provided. But the other thing that's happening at a very slow rate is that hydrogen is being lost into space. And that means that the whole planet is a little bit out of equilibrium at all times. And that generates sort of an ongoing chemical disequilibrium that life continues to feed on till today.
Is this just a matter of, like, adapting to changes?
It's not so much. Life has, as I say, another thing to say, of course, that life is, once life gets going, it's very good at exploiting whatever resources are available. So if a new kind of food becomes available, then there's selection for systems that can use that food. If an old kind of food starts becoming unavailable, then again, selection will favor ones that don't need it as well. So that will, they will certainly, life can find ways to make a living. As long as the things it makes a living on are continually replenished, it can continue to persist.
How long then do we think that it takes to create life if we go back to the beginning, from inorganic to organic?
Well, so, I mean, I guess I'm going to suggest maybe we let's not think about it that way, because I think it takes a view that somehow we can draw a very sharp line between the living and the non-living. It feels to me like the more we've come to understand how chemical systems can behave in sort of lifelike ways, maybe very without requiring a lot of complexity, I now view life as not an on-off switch, but sort of a gradual on-ramp. And I don't know how long it would take to go from something that we would all agree is not living to something that we would all agree is living. But whatever it was, it's a pretty drawn-out, lengthy process that probably took many millions of years.
So your prospects of creating something that we all agree is life in the lab would be rather long shot?
Yes, I think that's true.
You have to have a very large ongoing grant.
That would be nice if anybody wants to provide that, but yes.
Well, it's been a pleasure, David Baum. I'm sure there's much more that we could get into, and maybe we will sometime. But in the meantime, it's certainly been very enlightening.
Yeah, thank you. It's fun talking to you, Norman. Thanks.
I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you'll join me next time around for University of the Air.